Coming up is the news.
Headlines. People in Iran and many other parts of the world celebrated the Persian New Year, also known as Nowruz. In his New Year message, Iran's leader hails the Iranian nation for its fight against the coronavirus pandemic, as well as the U.S. maximum pressure campaign. Also in the headlines, the Yemeni army launches a fresh retaliatory attack on Saudi Arabia, this time hitting a military target at Abha Airport with a drone.
This is Muse. Thanks for joining us.
People in Iran and several other countries are celebrating the ancient festival of Nowruz, which marks the beginning of the Persian calendar year. People usually go shopping to prepare themselves for the arrival of spring. In Iran, Nowruz falls on March 21st of this year. One of the traditions of Nowruz is to set a table called hafsin, which contains seven items beginning with a Persian sound. Iranians both inside the country and abroad are in a festive mood as the day starts with a week-long holiday. Folks also make New Year resolutions, hoping to have a better year ahead. Another Nowruz tradition is to call on relatives and have get-togethers with family and friends. However, people this year have been advised to stay home and avoid travels and gatherings due to the coronavirus outbreak. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has highlighted the country's resistance in the face of the coronavirus crisis over the past year. Ayatollah Khamenei also praised the people in confronting the U.S. maximum pressure campaign, saying that Iran knew it was doomed to fail. He added that the enemies headed by the U.S. have even acknowledged the failure of the anti-Iran campaign. The leader underlined that the year 1400 is important, as there will be a presidential election and more steps to boost production. He called for legal and governmental mechanisms to remove obstacles to domestic growth. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks during a speech marking the Iranian New Year, or Nowruz. Meanwhile, President Hassan Rouhani says Iran's enemies have no way but to resume constructive interaction with the Islamic Republic. He made the comments in his New Year address to the nation. He said the enemies have admitted that they cannot speak to the Iranian nation with the language of force, threats, and sanctions. Rouhani was referring to the so-called U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Iran under the former U.S. President Donald Trump. He said that Trump's policy failed due to patience and perseverance of the Iranian nation. The president further called for national understanding in order to achieve economic stability and sustainable economic growth. In other news, Yemeni armed forces say that they have conducted drone strikes on a military target in Saudi Arabia's southwestern province of Asir. The spokesman for Ansarullah forces say the Yemenis have hit a military base in the Abha International Airport. No more details are available on possible casualties or damage. The Yemeni army has conducted several such attacks during the past few weeks. It says the attacks are retaliation for Saudi Arabia's devastating war on its southern neighbor. The six-year onslaught has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children. The situation in Lebanon has become unbearable for many people. They are faced with hyperinflation and rampant unemployment. A prolonged political deadlock is exacerbating the economic crisis there.
Lebanon is gripped by a double crisis, a persistent political vacuum as politicians fail to agree on a government, and a devastating economic meltdown. The situation has been widely described as the worst in Lebanon's history, with some warning that time is running out fast for those who wish to save it. Lebanon has been without a government for 7 months now. Prime Minister Hassan Diab resigned in August 2020, days after a massive chemical blast destroyed much of the port of Beirut and killed 200 people. Diab and his team have stayed on in a caretaker capacity, waiting for a new government that still eludes Lebanon. Different political camps are severely wrangling over the composition of the new government. Cabinet formations have always been tough in Lebanon, with political leaders usually divided over key cabinet posts. This week, Lebanese President Michel Aoun issued an ultimatum. He warned Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri to immediately form a new cabinet or go. The number of politicians and technocrats in any future cabinet is another bone of contention among major political camps. Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, said on Thursday that it would support a technocrat cabinet approved by the president and the prime minister designate, but warned that a government formed solely of specialists would not last. The formation of a new government is undoubtedly a crucial step, but there is no guarantee that it can pull Lebanon from the brink.
Many believe that Lebanon's economic meltdown is posing the most serious threat to its stability in many decades. Any new government will have to try to prevent Lebanon from sinking deeper into financial collapse. That's a tough task for any cabinet, as the Lebanese pound has lost 90% of its value.
Over the past year, Lebanon has been rocked by protests against corruption, unemployment, and poverty. But things have been getting tougher day after day. The Lebanese currency has lost 90% of its value. The dangerous downward trend has escalated over the past 2 weeks. The deepening financial crisis exacerbated by the coronavirus outbreak has eliminated jobs and pushed people deeper into poverty.
Half of the population is in real poverty now. Lebanon used to be a country with high standards of living, and now it's they have worthless currency. And since 2019, the financial crisis wiped out a lot of jobs and locked the people out of even their bank deposit after the financial crisis, and the embarrassment for the government and for the financial institution of a lot of corruption going on.
The population is right now facing the risk of widespread hunger. Many people are right now panic buying amid reports that fuel, wheat, and medicine subsidies may soon end. Lebanese officials have come under mounting pressure from inside and outside the country to find a way to form a new government to try to secure desperately needed foreign aid. Prime Minister designate Saad Hariri stressed after a meeting with President Michel Aoun on Thursday that forming a cabinet that could revive talks with the International Monetary Fund was the only option to avoid total financial collapse. Hariri says Lebanon needs to regain the trust of the international community to restructure its debt. Will main Lebanese actors put their differences aside and hammer out a compromise to try and resolve the crisis? The coming days and weeks will be crucial for the race against time to save Lebanon.
A new partial lockdown has gone into effect in France to prevent the spread of COVID-19. The restrictions have affected a third of the French population, with the capital Paris and parts of the north to remain locked for 4 weeks. Parisians packed trains leaving the city and crammed into shops ahead of the new restrictions. Prime Minister Jean Castex has said the country is in the grip of a third wave of coronavirus infections. Official figures indicate that the variant discovered in Britain accounts for nearly 75% of the new cases. People in Poland and parts of Ukraine also woke up to tight restrictive measures. Chris Denhand has cited reasons as to why the lockdown may not be effective in containing the spread of the coronavirus in France.
Today we see that many people in Paris, they are running away from the capital of France to areas that are not under the lockdown. So this will necessarily increase new contaminations, that's for sure. And secondly, schools are centers of contaminations, and the French government is not closing schools because they want the economy going on, they want people go to work. But at the same time, children are contaminating each other. They do not have the symptoms. Fortunately, they are not sick, but they contaminate their parents and their grandparents. And then third main remark and the main criticism is the lack of a massive, rapid vaccination campaign. So France, they say it's a rich, developed country. They were not able to find their own vaccine, so they are dependent on importing the U.S. vaccines, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and also the new one, Johnson & Johnson. France refuses still to import the Russian and the Chinese vaccine. The direct consequence is that many people want to be be vaccinated, and there are no vaccines. I mean, there are huge buildings open and available for people to come to be vaccinated, but there is a lack of jabs, lack of vaccines. The quantity of the vaccines is absolutely not sufficient.
India has reported nearly 41,000 more coronavirus cases, the biggest jump in daily infections in nearly 4 months. The new figure has pushed the total caseload in the world's third worst affected country to 11.6 million. More than half of the infections have been reported in the state of Maharashtra, which is home to densely populated commercial hub Mumbai. Several other states have also seen a surge in cases. The spike has forced some districts to take containment measures, including lockdowns and the closure of public venues. Doctors blame the fresh infection wave on people's relaxed attitude to mask wearing and to social distancing measures. This is while India's vaccination campaign is progressing slowly, with only 42 million out of over 1.3 billion people vaccinated so far. India's fatalities are nearing 160,000. U.S. President Joe Biden has denounced the scourge of violence against Asian Americans in his country.
Too many Asian Americans have been walking up and down the streets and worrying, waking up each morning the past year feeling their safety and the safety of their loved ones are at stake. They've been attacked, blamed, scapegoated, and harassed. They've been verbally assaulted, physically assaulted, killed.
Biden made the remarks during a visit to the state of Georgia to console the Asian American community following a series of killings in Atlanta. Biden said that hate has no place in the U.S. and has called for an end to, quote, the ugly poison that has long haunted the country. He underlined the silence is complicity in race-related violence, that the nation must not be complicit in the face of racism and xenophobia. VP Kamala Harris also condemned the slurs and violence against the community, calling racism a real issue in the U.S.
Racism is real in America, and it has always been. Xenophobia is real in America, and always has been. Sexism, too.
Harris also condemned, quote, people in positions of incredible power for spreading hate. On Tuesday, a deadly shooting rampage in Atlanta left 8 people dead, including 6 women of Asian descent. Asian Americans have been grappling with a rise in hate crimes since the coronavirus outbreak. The former U.S. President Donald Trump had directly blamed China for the pandemic, repeatedly calling the virus a Chinese one. People have taken to the streets across Myanmar again in defiance of the junta's campaign of violence and fear to crush anti-coup protests. Protesters wearing gas masks rallied in northern Shan State to demand the release of ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi. In the southern city of Dawei, demonstrators called for an end to military rule. Other cities, including commercial capital Yangon, were also the scene of protests against the military. Myanmar has been in turmoil since the army toppled Suu Kyi from power in a coup on February the 1st. Security forces have used tear gas, rubber bullets, and live rounds against anti-coup protesters. So far, more than 230 people have been killed in anti-coup unrest. The U.S. says it had candid exchanges with China in their first face-to-face talks under U.S. President Joe Biden's administration.
There are a number of areas where we are fundamentally at odds, including China's actions in Xinjiang, with regard to Hong Kong, Tibet, increasingly Taiwan, as well as actions that it's taking in cyberspace. And it's no surprise that when we raised those issues, clearly and directly, we got a defensive response. But we were also able to have a very candid conversation.
Antony Blinken said the interests of Washington and Beijing intersect on Iran, North Korea, and Afghanistan. Blinken was speaking at the end of the two-day talks with his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi, in Alaska. Wang, for his part, called for a policy of no conflict by both sides. He noted that sovereignty is a matter of principle for Beijing and that Washington should not underestimate China's determination to defend its sovereignty. That was a reference to tensions with Washington over Taiwan and Hong Kong after the two sides traded barbs over the issues at the beginning of their meeting.
The first high-level meeting between the U.S. and China under Joe Biden's presidency gets off to a frosty start, putting the deeply strained relations between the two countries on public display. The opening session of a two-day meeting in Alaska saw top American and Chinese officials hurling accusations at each other in front of the world media. During the meeting, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken accused China of threatening the global stability, conducting cyber attacks against the U.S., and practicing economic coercion. He also lashed out at Beijing for what he called committing human rights violations, including in Hong Kong. Senior Chinese diplomat Yang Jiechi reacted by calling the U.S. allegations hypocritical. He noted that Washington's own human rights records are at a low point, especially with regard to its treatment of African Americans who are being, quote, slaughtered there. Yang also accused Washington of using its military might and financial power to suppress other countries. The senior Chinese official said Washington, with its unfounded allegations, is trying to obstruct normal trade exchanges and inciting some countries to attack China. The two top economies have been at loggerheads for years over a host of issues, including trade, cybersecurity, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. The U.S. has also been on the forefront over China's maritime dispute with some of its neighbors over the South China Sea, siding with Beijing's rivals and routinely dispatching warships and warplanes to the region. Experts believe the U.S. is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power.
The United States is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power. Now, China has an economy that's roughly half the size of that of the United States, but China has been making gains on the United States, as we know, in recent years.
The Sino-American relations sank to their lowest level under former President Donald Trump, who initiated a trade war with China using tariffs as a pressure tool. The Biden administration has taken a somber approach as it views the Sino-American relations as the biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century. However, it has so far refrained from rolling back Trump's policies to mend bilateral relations. It appears Biden is following in Trump's footsteps not only with regard to China, but other global issues. 2 months after his inauguration, Biden has also failed to live up to his campaign promise of returning to the UN-endorsed 2015 Iran nuclear deal that was signed during his vice presidency but abandoned by Trump in 2018. Iran says Biden is no different from his predecessor when it comes to honoring the accord. Tensions have also escalated between Moscow and Washington in recent days, with Russia warning that bilateral ties are, quote, on the brink of collapse, that after the U.S. president called his Russian counterpart a killer and warned that Vladimir Putin will pay the price for what he claimed meddling in the U.S. presidential election.
China has lashed out at the United States' human rights record, urging Washington to tackle the problem of racism in the U.S. China's deputy ambassador to the United Nations, Dai Bing, said the White House should address the problems of racial discrimination, social injustice, and police brutality in the United States. His comments came in response to remarks by the U.S. ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, who is black. She criticized China and several other countries for what she called racism and oppression against minorities. The U.S. has come under fire by much of the global community and international organizations for racial profiling, discrimination against African Americans. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the 8th session of the Assembly.
یک مثال دیگری که از اینها به نظر من مهمتره این آیه شریفه ما ارسلنا من رسول الا لیطاع باذن الله.
Another example which in my opinion is more important than the others is this holy ayah. We sent not an apostle but to be obeyed in accordance with the will of Allah. Noble Quran chapter 4 verse 64. How many of the prophets fought in Allah's way and with them fought large groups of godly men? The Noble Quran chapter 3 verse 146. Imam Khomeini brought this concept to the arena of action. He utilized the ayah, I admonish you on one point, that you rise before Allah, it may be in pairs or it might be singly. The Noble Quran, chapter 34, verse 46, in that direction. He utilized the ayah, I admonish you on one point, that you rise before Allah, it may be in pairs or it may be singly, in that direction. It may be in pairs or it may be singly does not mean saying daily prayers. Rather, it means establishing a government and an Islamic system. Imam Khomeini utilized this concept and launched a movement with it in the year 1341 in the Iranian calendar.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger among
بعد در طول زمان متفکرین، علاقمندان، ارادتمندان، شاگردان امام و در رأس همه خود امام.
Later on, thinkers, enthusiasts, imam supporters and pupils and at the top of them imam himself promoted this thought in the course of time until it led to the establishment and victory of the revolution and the government based on the revolution. Notice that Quranic and Islamic concepts and the ideological concepts of Islam can exert such an influence in life once they're implemented in practice. So, this is an example of the miraculous effects of such a procedure and endeavor. How we should carry out this task is another issue. Then, the Islamic government was established.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Africa Today. Last January, the United Nations International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea ruled that Britain has no sovereignty over the Chagos Islands. The Mauritius Prime Minister has slammed Britain for refusing to return control of these islands to his country.
The UK continues to ignore the International Court of Justice, as well as its obligations under international law, by maintaining its unlawful occupation of the Chagos Archipelago.
Hello and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on Britain's dismissal of a United Nations court decision that demanded it stops colonizing the Chagos Islands in the Indian Ocean. We are asking, what's the reason behind Britain's arrogance and refusal to vacate Chagos Islands? In the second segment of our program, we are analyzing the upsurge in attacks and kidnappings by the Boko Haram terrorist group in Nigeria. We are asking, why has the Nigerian government failed to defeat this terror group? Join us for an incisive analysis on these two issues with our experts. And don't forget to send your comments as you watch our show today.
Why is Britain colonizing Chagos? In January this year, the United Nations International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea ruled that the United Kingdom has no sovereignty over the Chagos Islands. These strategically located Indian Ocean islands also include Diego Garcia, home to a major U.S. military base. The UN body's judgment follows a ruling by the International Court of Justice in February 2019 that the UK must end its occupation of Chagos. Delivering his judgment, the then president of the International Court of Justice, Abdullahi Ahmed Yusuf, was categorical that the United Kingdom must vacate the Chagos archipelago.
That the United Kingdom has an obligation to bring to an end its administration of the Chagos archipelago as rapidly as possible, and that all member states must cooperate with the United Nations to complete the decolonization of Mauritius.
The 73rd session of UN General Assembly in May 2019 also overwhelmingly supported the ruling by the ICJ on Chagos Archipelago and the complete decolonization of Mauritius.
On draft resolution A/73/L84 revision 1, entitled Advisory Opinion of the International Court of Justice on the Legal Consequences of the Separation of the Chagos Archipelago from Mauritius in 1965. Will all delegations confirm that the votes are accurately reflected on the screen?
The United Kingdom has arrogantly rejected decisions by all the three international bodies. Despite London's belligerence, the people of Chagos are unrelenting in their quest for justice.
Now, in this regard, charges have been filed in the International Criminal Court against the British military representative at Diego Garcia over allegations of apartheid against Chagosians. Jonathan Levy, the lawyer for those forcibly removed from the archipelago, has demanded that the culprits be arrested and brought to trial in The Hague. Now, to discuss more on Britain's continued colonization of Chagos, we have contacted Dr. Levy, who is also a professor of international law at Norwich University. Thanks a lot for your time, Dr. Levy.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Dr. Levy, now representing the indigenous Chagosians, you have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. and the U.K. in the International Criminal Court. Now, please briefly elaborate about that case.
Yes, I'm representing the Chagosian people in both damage claims and an action before the International Criminal Court, where we're asking the International Criminal Court to investigate apartheid against the Chagosian Islanders by Great Britain. And the reason for that is the Chagosians were unlawfully and forcefully deported from their homeland by Great Britain, and laws put into effect that stripped them of their citizenship, of their property rights, and any right to return to the Chagos Islands. No other subject people have been treated that way by Great Britain, and we feel it's solely because these are an African people, and there's racist motives that have been reflected in the actions of Great Britain all along.
Now, thanks a lot for that, Dr. Levy, and stay tuned for more.
Britain, with its trademark imperial arrogance, once again dismissed a United Nations court decision that it has no entitlement to the Chagos Islands.
A spokesperson for the British Foreign Office said Mauritius has never held sovereignty over the Chagas, and the UK does not recognize its claim.
Britain has arrogantly rejected the ruling by the UN tribunal that basically demands that it ends the colonization of Chagos Islands. Now, what's your take on this rejection?
Yes, Britain is rejecting the rule of international law. Britain is rejecting the findings of the UN General Assembly, the African Union, and of two UN courts, the International Court of Justice and the International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea. So we have Britain acting in this fashion solely because of its military relationship with the United States. In essence, Britain is saying it will not respect international law because it has the backing of the United States.
Well, there you have it. Britain is acting with impunity because the U.S. backs its actions. So, Mr. Levy, what happens next after Britain's rejection of the ruling by the U.N. tribunal, and how will Mauritius continue to pursue its rightful sovereignty over the Chagos Islands?
Overwhelmingly, the U.N. General Assembly and international organizations have recognized Mauritius as the sovereign over the Chagos Islands. But the United States and the United Kingdom have made it clear that any attempts by Mauritius to physically claim its territory will be met by military force and will be repulsed. So the Mauritians cannot enter the territorial waters, for example, of the Chagos Islands, even though that is their territory. Mauritius, therefore, must use other methods since it can't militarily compete with the United States or United Kingdom. For example, Mauritius could and should make a referral to the International Criminal Court regarding the apartheid exclusion of the Chagosians from their homes. Mauritius could also assert sovereignty by assigning commercial and property rights to the Chagos Islands, to the Chagosians and others who might be willing to act privately. And finally, Mauritius and like-minded countries should recognize Argentinian claims to the Falkland Islands in retaliation for this bully behavior by the United Kingdom.
Nearly 2,000 indigenous inhabitants of the colonized Chagas Archipelago were forcibly evicted in the early 1970s so that the largest island, Diego Garcia, could be leased to the U.S. to use as an airbase. The people of Chagas have never been allowed to return home. What is the situation of the indigenous inhabitants of Chagas who were forced to vacate their land to give way to a massive U.S. military base in Diego Garcia?
The situation of my clients, the Chagosians, is not a good one and hasn't been for decades. In fact, some of them are still stateless people because of the actions of Great Britain in deporting them. They are badly in need of aid. Great Britain has lied to the United Nations and claimed there was a $50 million support fund to help the Chagosians. That was a lie that was told by the UN ambassador of Great Britain. They were assured these payments would be made, yet, according to the Guardian newspaper in England, only 12,000 pounds of a 40 million pound fund has ever been paid out, and that money wasn't even given directly to Chagosians. Older Chagosians are dying in despair that they'll ever see their homeland again, and many Chagosians are living in poverty, all the while England is putting a false face to the world that it's benevolent toward the Chagosians, yet the facts speak otherwise.
The recent judgment by the UN tribunal on Chagas Islands is not just a blow to Britain, but also to the United States and its military adventurism. U.S. warplanes flying from Diego Garcia base have been used to bomb civilians in countries such as Iraq and Afghanistan and threaten adversaries such as China and Iran.
Dr. Levy, you earlier talked about the link between the occupation of Chagos by Britain and the presence of a U.S. military base in Diego Garcia. Now, do you think this secretive airbase is the main reason that Britain continues to illegally occupy the Chagos Island?
Oh, absolutely. That is the main question. The U.S. base was the reason, the only reason, for the deportation of the Chagosians. The U.S. military base on Diego Garcia is the reason for the apartheid laws to keep the Chagosians out of the entire Chagos archipelago. The U.S., not Great Britain, is the real master of the Chagos Islands. And for reasons that are not really clear, the U.S. wants all of the Chagos Atolls clear of people. Even though there's only a single military base at Diego Garcia, they want a massive section of the Indian Ocean clear of all population. It is true that there's a massive base at Diego Garcia, which houses Naval, Air Force, and U.S. Space Force assets now, but still, they have tried to clear a actual immense section of the Indian Ocean from all scrutiny.
The U.S. has made every effort to draw attention to alleged disregard for international law by its adversaries, while conveniently ignoring that law's application to the U.S. presence on Diego Garcia. Now, what's your take, Mr. Levy?
It must be remembered that the United States is the main opponent of international law in the world. The United States does not recognize the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice. The United States has ignored rulings against it on Nicaragua, and former President Trump even put sanctions on the International Criminal Court and its prosecutors. The Biden administration has not removed those sanctions. If the U.S. ever wants to regain respect in international relations, it must honor its international obligations and follow international law. President Biden campaigned for president, claiming he was the greatest anti-apartheid fighter in the history of the United States Congress. Yet here we are, with the U.S. supporting English racism in the Chagos Islands. Again and again, the hypocrisy continues.
Now, from our conversation today, it's quite clear that a lot needs to be done to eject Britain from its last colony in Africa. Here at Africa Today, we shall keep you posted on the struggle for the liberation of Chagos. Stay tuned, and we'll be back soon with analysis on the upsurge of Boko Haram attacks in northern Nigeria.
Surge in Boko Haram attacks.
The Boko Haram terrorist group has increased its deadly attacks and kidnappings in Nigeria. There is concern that this terrorist group is changing tactics and carrying out more kidnappings for ransom. In February, Boko Haram terrorists kidnapped more than 300 schoolgirls, marking the third mass abduction since December.
The general security situation is taking a turn for the worse. Amit reports that in the first 6 weeks of 2021, at least 1,525 Nigerians were killed across the country. Women and children are bearing the brunt of insecurity in Nigeria. A woman here mourns the killing of her brother.
For more analysis on the security situation in Nigeria, especially the spike in Boko Haram attacks, we have contacted Dr. Mojubaolu Okome, a professor of political science at Brooklyn College of City University of New York. Thanks a lot for your time, madam.
My pleasure.
Dr. Okome, can we say that the recent increase in attacks by Boko Haram is a pointer that this Takfiri terrorist group is still strong despite claims by the government that it's technically defeated?
Yes, unfortunately, Boko Haram is still strong because It's able to swoop down at will, abduct people. So the scope of its activities is spreading. It was in the Northeast, and now we are having more action in the Northwest.
Thanks, Dr. Okome. Now, you have said there that Boko Haram attacks are spreading far and wide. Now, why has the Nigerian government failed to defeat this terrorist group despite having one of the strongest armies in Africa?
I think that Nigerian government has to really do a serious assessment about its strategies and its what it's done so far, to identify why it has been impossible to end this reign of terror by Boko Haram, despite the fact that actually our president had said that technically Boko Haram was defeated. But technicalities are not what we need. We need for Nigerian school children to be safe and secure. We need Nigerian citizens to feel the security that comes from Boko Haram actually being defeated in reality. That hasn't happened, and it is unacceptable.
Indeed, it's unacceptable that innocent Nigerians have suffered for over 10 years as Boko Haram continues to grow stronger. But who's funding or sustaining the activities of Boko Haram? Who are the foreign backers, if any, of Boko Haram terrorists?
One thing that Boko Haram has said clearly is that it owes allegiance to ISIS, you know. And, you know, so there are allegations that are thrown around about foreign backers of all sorts, about the porous nature of Nigeria's borders, about the arms and ammunition, very dangerous ones, that have flooded the market after Gaddafi's fall, being cheaply available to groups like Boko Haram, whoever the backers are.
Dr. Okome there mentioned that the ISIS terrorist group is the international affiliate of the Boko Haram. Now, lest we forget, the extremist Wahhabi ideology that is propagated and promoted by Saudi Arabia is the reason for the existence of ISIS or Daesh terrorist group, and indeed other terrorist groups such as Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram that are spreading mayhem and killing innocent people in Africa. Now, how has the spread of Wahhabism contributed to the increase in power of Takfiri terrorist groups such as Boko Haram?
Oh, tremendously. You know, because there are these values that are held by groups that espouse Wahhabism. They are very convinced that their version of Islam is the only legitimate one. They are wedded to a very draconian interpretation. They're very intolerant. Frankly, you know, they are not accepted by many Muslims as legitimate in their take about what to do in society as Muslims, what to do as Muslims who are obedient to the will of Allah, and how to relate to fellow Muslims and other non-Muslim religious communities and even secular communities.
The Boko Haram insurgency has displaced over 2.5 million people in the Lake Chad Basin. Civilians in Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger continue to be affected by grave violations of human rights, widespread sexual and gender-based violence, forced recruitment, and suicide bombings. A Nigerian living in a refugee camp does not see the situation improving soon.
Now I'm in God's hands. If peace is restored one day and I'm told I can go back home, I'll go back to my village immediately. But time goes by and the situation isn't changing, so there's no way I can go home.
How are the Boko Haram attacks impacting on the daily lives of Nigerians?
Wahhabism has strengthened the capacity of groups like Boko Haram to cause devastation and, you know, inflict a lot of brutal pain on people. You know, so in Nigeria, over 2 million people are internally displaced as a result of Boko Haram's rampaging. First of all, at that time, it was the over 2 million is when it was active only in the northeast. Now it has extended to the northwest, so the number of internally displaced people is going to rise.
The unrest has become a political problem for President Muhammadu Buhari, who has faced mounting criticism in recent months over high-profile attacks by Boko Haram terrorists and bandits. During his New Year's speech, Buhari admitted that Boko Haram attacks have thwarted his government efforts to eradicate poverty.
In parts of the country where chronic poverty, social exclusion, and disillusionment among sections of the youth were already a problem, the circles of violence that had been unleashed by mindless groups like Boko Haram and others have thwarted the efforts of government to undertake the social policy and associated investments that could make a huge difference in the quality of life of our citizens.
Now, Dr. Akome, as we wind up, can you tell us what will it take to defeat Boko Haram terrorists?
Efforts need to be made to build peace based on psychological, social, economic, and military strategies. Only the military strategy won't work, especially because these are not people who are like an orthodox formal army, you know. They're in communities among people who are afraid of them, who will not probably speak out against them because they are afraid of reprisal. So the normal military strategies are not sufficient to fight this. And, you know, within Islam too, the Muslim leaders need to really do a lot of work to convince people who have bought into this ideology that there are ways of being obedient to Allah, of being a Muslim, that totally is diametrically opposed to the Boko Haram perspective.
Now, Dr. Okome there says that a military strategy is not enough to defeat Boko Haram, and that there are cultural, economic, and religious dimensions to the Northern Nigeria conflict. Well, that's it for this edition of Africa Today. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, I'd like to thank you all. Take care and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Oh, I'm not
the spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, He is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبه نستعين إنه خير ناصر ومؤين. The month is the month of Sha'ban, the month of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The occasions in which we do have some relevance to our imams, such as the birthday of imams or martyrdoms of imams, we should have some good benefits of these occasions in seeking a proximity to God and performing our responsibility and duties toward these imams. And the one who is aware of his own personality and his relationship to his own imam can take benefit more of these occasions. Then let us focus on ourselves, focus on the day and night that we are in, and seek God's forgiveness, mercy and blessings through our imams, especially Imam Al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam. Talking about the personality of Imam Al-Husayn is not so easy for me, because Imam is such a notion. We cannot talk about the depth of this personality, but to the extent of our own understanding, we can talk a little bit about his characteristics and nobility, and take our own benefit to the extent of our own perception of this Imam. Just one point I want to focus on, and then to go next to that point and come to an end, inshallah, at the end, good conclusion I want to mention. Imam had many, many characteristics, and you all know about most of them. I don't want to talk about these things. Just one issue is very important for me in the life of Imam Al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam, and that is his generosity. I remember a story. In this story, one of the Arabs, you know, Bedouin Arab, came to Imam Al-Husayn asking for something, some debt that he had. He said, "Oh Hussein, because I guaranteed full, you know, payment of blood price for somebody, and now I'm empty-handed, I don't have enough money to pay, then I decided to come to the door of the most generous person, and that is you. I'm asking for that money, if you give me." Imam said, "I want to ask you three questions. If you answer the first one, I'll give you one third of the money. If you answer the second one, I'll give you two-thirds of your money and debt. If you answer the whole question that I'm, you know, asking, then you can receive the whole money and the debt that you're wanting." He said, "You are Imam? And the most knowledgeable person, you're asking me something, and you're expecting that I can be able to do that? To answer the questions?" "Okay." Imam said, "Prophet Muhammad had something here. He said, generosity, goodness is due to the extent of knowledge. If you want to pay something, you have to consider the understanding of that person who is in need." He said, "Okay, if you want me to be so, then I'm ready. If I know the answer, I can talk about the answer. If I don't know, I can learn it from you. This is the best occasion for learning. Imam started to ask the first question, Ayyul a'mal afdal? What is the best deed in your point of view? There are many, many deeds are recommended in Islam. Which one is the best? He said, Al-Imanu billah. Faith in God is the best deed. If you believe in God, then you've done the best action. If you don't believe, nothing works. And other works are useless. And other actions are rewardless. First, believe in God. So, believe and faith is counted as an action here. And this is the best action because this is the action of heart and soul. Aqdul qalb. So this is some action. It's going to be done by our heart. And the best action. Believe in God. Well done. The second question. فَمَنْ نَجَاتُ مِنَ الْهَلَكَ. What is the salvation and safety from the danger? You want to save yourself, your life? What is the way for that? To be immune from danger. Is there another way for that? He said, الثَّقَةُ بِاللَّهِ. Trust in God. Reliance in God. You know, sometimes we're thinking about a supporter for us to support us in our difficulties. We're seeking for a helper to help us in our need, in our difficulties. The best helper and supporter is God Himself. You have to rely on God, not other people. God is the most strongest one. He is strong. He is stable. He is powerful. We have to trust in God, not other people. Well done. This is the second question. You answered them successfully. The third one and the final question. Imam asked the person, فَمَا يُزَيِّنُ الرَّجُلُ. What adorns human being? What is the adornment of mankind? Is that best dressing? Is that gold and silver? Is that fashion that we have today? What is the adornment of mankind? He said, عِلْمٌ مَعَهُ حِلْمٌ. This is the adornment of mankind. Knowledge accompanied by hilm, tolerance, insight, patience. If you're alim without practicing any kind of tolerance, then this ilm is not useful for you. You have to tolerate another people who are knowledgeable or lay people. You have to stand them. Yes, you may face some people who are against your own idea, who are against your dignity. They behave in a way, they harm your dignity, your position in the society. You have to tolerate them. We understand all these things from the tradition of Prophet and the other Imams. How they tolerate the lay people. They didn't know a respectful way of treating, but Prophet and Imams stand them. This is something we have to understand and focus on, brothers. قال عليه السلام فإن أخطأه ذلك. Imam asked the person, if he missed that, then what? If there's no, you know, science with tolerance, is there another thing to, you know, replace that? He said, فَمَالٌ مَعَهُ مُرُوءَ. Wealth and property accompanied by generosity. If you have property without generosity, then you're wasting your time. Then you're not worthy of being, you know, respected by the other people. If you have